Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
There's always been a particular worry about the virtue of justice. Justice involves our relations with others, to some extent, and others' good. Now, some of you are interested in Plato's Republic, where we have at the beginning of Book 2, Glaucon arguing, for the sake of argument, again, Plato does not defend this view, that it's better to appear just and to be unjust and to get everything than to, in fact, be just and not reap the reward. So it seems like justice, a lot of people think about it as the best policy. Honesty is the best policy, right? So they want to justify, or crime doesn't pay. So people want to make justice valuable because of what it brings. When Plato's concern is to think about justice, does it have some worth in itself? Right. And this is a feature in some way of ancient philosophical discussions. We can even find it today. We have different notions of morality, a different history of moral discussion. But there's this concern with what's just and what's useful, and in particular, what's useful for me. There are different views that you can have. Cicero, I think, he's a popularizer of philosophy. He draws it out very clearly in this text from the De Officiis. He says, if we are born for moral rectitude, and if that is either the only thing worth seeking, as Zeno thought, or at least to be esteemed as infinitely outweighing everything else, as Aristotle holds, then it necessarily follows that the morally right is either the sole good or the supreme good. And that which is good is certainly expedient or useful. Consequently, that which is moral right will also be expedient. But people who are not upright think about it this way. They think about material rewards, right? And so their concern is not being caught, not being punished for acting unjustly, because they see justice as something instrumental or an agreement that we follow for our own benefit. I'm not going to rob you if you don't rob me. And the problem is that these discussions can lead to a question of what are the effects of acting just? Rather, is justice bad in itself? And they don't see, as Plato says, the greatest penalty of all, which is being unjust, right? It's not that being unjust has bad effects, but that it makes you an unjust person. It makes your life worse. So there are two related questions that we can sometimes think about. First, these statements about what's just, what's good for me, what makes the statements true? Right. And when you think about it, our ordinary moral notions, it's very hard to see how they map onto reality. We don't see them the way that we might see a color.
Right.
Different people have different notions of what's good and wrong. It's also, why should I care? And in our history, there's also a tendency to separate morality from facts about human nature. I think you have one of the earliest nicely clear examples. I think you have this in the 14th century with Ockham, who wants to make things right or wrong depending on God's command. But I have in this text for you from Pierre Dailly a nice thought experiment, right? No contradiction, he says, arises if God wills the rational creature to exist and does not will to bind it to something. In fact, that's what happens with irrational creatures, right? Meaning non-rational, like dogs or fish or whatever. So Dai wonders, well, maybe God could just create a world that's the same as the world as we live in now. And there's no contradiction to think about such a world existing, but there being no morality at all, right? The world would be the same. Dai thinks that what gives up morality is an extra property involving a will, in particular God's will. We have later discussions like this where they say, well, it's not God's will, it's maybe people's expressions of approval or disapproval or a certain kind of rationality, but they want to distance morality from facts about human nature or the world and create a separate moral realm that has its own standards, its own justifications, okay? So we have this question about what is morality, and then the other question, why should I care about it, right? And so you might say, well, because God says so, okay? Well, why should I care about what God says? Well, because it's the right thing to do. You owe it to God. Well, how do I know I owe it to God? Because God says so? It's a little bit, right? So just to think about these issues, I wanted to discuss three issues. One, what is the human good? I'll discuss Thomas's point that it's a good that's proper to humans and relative to, or at least in agreement with human nature. The second point is that human good is happiness, and that's where we see the connection with virtue, because happiness is necessarily connected with a kind of virtuous activity. And then third, to see how it relates to others, and justice, virtues like justice, where we're concerned with others' goods and others for their own sake, we can see that being good, it's not our particular good that we're concerned most with, or at least should be. It's the good of our communities, and then ultimately the good of the whole universe that God created. So first, what is the human good? How would it be connected with human nature? Well, Aristotle, if you're reading the Physics, I think that, you know, I hold the view, many people now hold it, that I know, but maybe not many people that you know, that Aristotle's Physics, a lot of those general discussions in the book, The Physics, that's where you get his more general teachings, that's easier to know, and that's often more or less correct. And you might say, well, we have atomists now. Really? Right? I mean, but atoms, are they really atoms like Democritus thought? Is there really a void like Democritus thought? No, I mean, it's not, right? I mean, if you read his accounts of like how cows digest or something like that, that's particular things you need people working long periods of time. I mean, we know so much more than Aristotle knew, but something like the Physics, it's kind of general principles, how to think about change. And when you think of activities, they have a certain direction, right? Like what happens when you boil water, the water gets hot. When you think about living things, just built into the kind of thing, there seems to be a certain direction. Living things grow. They reproduce, right? And what's good for a thing is often connected with its kind, what it is. More narrowly, you might talk, just in terms of human tools, we could say, well, this is a pretty good pencil. Why? Because the lead doesn't break off when I hit it. Some of these pencils you buy now, the lead breaks off, right? It's good for writing. A knife is good for cutting, right? And somebody might say, yes, but I don't like the way that you tried to cut somebody up before the talk, right? Somebody heard me, I got angry. Somebody asked me a question and said they were going to heckle me during the talk, so I chased after them with a knife, right? You'd say, that's not good. Well, there's a difference between being a good human being and being a good knife, right? The knife was probably pretty good, right? That big long knife that we have out here somewhere, used to, for the cheese and things, right? Sharp, it's tough, that's a good knife. It's connected with a function or purpose, what something is. Living things, azalea, certain fertilizers are good for azalea because they help the azalea to grow and flourish. And some animals have a social aspect, right? The dolphin pod, it's good for the pod. We can talk about this is a healthy pod. Everybody's playing their own role in the dolphin. We don't have the lone dolphin out hunting fish on his own. They send signals to each other underwater, right? There's a functioning, a coordination. Or the same thing with a wolf pack, right? And again, what's good is species relative. So what's good for a whale or is not good for a wolf, right? Or a human being, like a wolf, what would happen if he tried to live an aquatic life? Probably be fairly unsuccessful, right? Sometimes whales end up on the beach. If you've ever smelled after that happens, you realize it wasn't good for the whale, right? Some people like to go sun themselves on the beach, but when the whale tries to do it, it's bad news, right? So you can think about kinds and what's good for that kind. Now, when you think about the kinds, you have to think about what's peculiar to the nature, right? So if you think about your cat or your dog, or say a pile of dirt, right? They all have some pretty similar features. Like you could take a pile of dirt on the top of this building, drop it off, your cat, your dog, they're all going to fall down because they're heavy objects, right? Something in common they have, right? They're all going to have a certain point at which you vaporize them, right? You put them in a certain temperature or something. That's not really what's proper to the kind of thing, though, to dogs or cats, right? You could use cats, you could put them in a catapult and fling them across, but that's not really what cats are about. Cats are about reproducing, growing, eating, right? All of those different things, not being thrown in a catapult. Certain properties peculiar to them. Now, if you think about human beings, what's peculiar to human beings? We can think in a way that they can't, right? Your cat might know, ooh, that's big, that's small. I run away from the big thing towards the small thing, right? But in terms of the geometry involved, the mathematics involved, your cat's not going to be able to do that, right? Nor your dog, right? Horses that supposedly even can just count, usually they do studies and people are moving their heads a little bit, right? It's not even that the owners are manipulating the horses, it's that there are these unconscious signals that the people are giving to the horses, right? So the horse kind of, the person will move his head like this when there's a certain point where the horse should stop counting with its hooves. So it's this ability to think and reason about the good. And so we have this text from Thomas Aquinas, text number 5. So it is peculiar to a rational nature that it should tend towards an end in the sense of impelling or leading itself towards that end, where it is proper to a non-rational creature that it should tend towards an end in the sense of being impelled or being led by something else, either towards an apprehended end, as in the case of brute animals, but towards a non-apprehended end, as in the case of those things that lack cognition altogether, right? I mean, the heavy things just fall down. They don't think about it. But your cat, what happens? It sees the food. It goes towards it, right? It's moved by its desire for food, unless it's scared by the dog near it, right? Your dog sees the food. Your dog sees a female dog in heat. He goes after it. There might be things that stop the dog or cat, but it's not because they've been thinking about, is this good for me or not? Or is this right or not, right? It's not, there is a kind of thinking in comparison. So it's not as if they're without a thought in the broad sense, but there's not going to be the same kind of reasoning, right? Now, some of you might say, well, you haven't seen my boyfriend. Okay, no, right? Even if somebody acts on these desires all the time, the very fact that they're a human being and they're thinking about it means there's some reason involved. They may seem like complete idiots, okay? And they may act like idiots, but that doesn't mean that their actions are the same as the actions of a dog or cat with the same motive, right? It's not quite the same thing. And so it's this use of reason that is distinctively human and connected with the human good. Ability to actually think things through. Because your dog has all sorts of feelings, right? Your dog probably has feelings of love for you. Your dog, is down when you say bad dog, right? But bad dog's not quite the same as bad boyfriend, right? Bad dog is just acting like a dog, and maybe you can train it differently. If your boyfriend's bad, what do? You don't train him like a dog, okay? Right? If your boyfriend's bad, you can talk with him about why do you think this kind of behavior is okay? What are your goals and things, right? Do you really think that sitting on the couch watching football all day, every day, and growing fatter and fatter is the best way to live, right? You can talk about him, right? Don't put a collar on his neck. And then when he goes near the couch, he gets a zap, right? You can do that with a dog. That's a good way of training your dog. I mean, it might be what you have to do with certain people, but it's not a particularly human way of changing somebody's behavior, right? Zapping them with the dog collar. Okay, second point. So what is this then, this human good? Oh, there, Aristotle, it's a little bit complex. I mean, in some ways it involves moral virtues, which are virtues that involve desires for certain goods, other people, emotions, appetite generally, some sort of desire, and intellectual virtues, which are in some ways more important, which ultimately for Aristotle, as all, I think, the decent ancient philosophers held, involved thinking about the highest things, which were immaterial, right? Platonists and Aristotle's agreed about that. Not Stoics, not Epicureans, but I think the better ancient philosophers all thought that the human good involved, in some important way, the contemplation of the highest immaterial beings and being, or thing beyond being, whatever you want to call it. Something not like your ordinary things. Okay. So what is this? It's an activity. And you might think, well, that, acting in accordance with reason doesn't sound very good to me, right? I've got this Halloween party coming up after the talk, and I was hoping that I wouldn't be acting in accordance with reason, right? I was hoping I would be blasted by 12 o'clock and having a good time, right? Right. In fact, I want to kill my reason in order to have a good time. Okay, see, the seminarian's nodding. I was hoping he wouldn't be, but this just goes to show, hopefully you're still in formation, right? So at some point, okay.
You can't see it, but underneath there's a shock collar.
Okay, good. Right. Now, a lot of times, I mean, this is a problem when we talk about happiness, is sometimes there's not a real great other word for it in philosophy, but people think of happiness, well, this is like feeling good or psychological happiness, right? The world's good, things are going well, I'm happy about my relations with other people. I even had an anxiety attack for a while. I don't feel like jumping off a bridge. I take pleasure in my ordinary relations with others, right? I'm learning more about my gender identity, right? All of these things, right? Feels good, feels right. God knows what these people are talking about when they talk about happiness sometimes. It's kind of ill-defined. There is this notion of psychological health that I'm sometimes unclear about. Sometimes at Mass, they'll pray for people's spiritual, psychological, and physical health. I can kind of understand natural spiritual health, maybe. I mean, if you have a healthy brain, I hope that you're not going to have horrible psychological things, right? Because your brain's okay. Now, it might be your fault that your brain isn't okay. You might have used drugs or something, and so you've got all sorts of things. Might be your genes, but I can understand a healthy and unhealthy brain. We all need healthy brains to function and to reason. At least in this life, we can't operate without healthy brains. So I know what that means, more or less. But whatever it is, you can imagine that the good person who's acting reasonably, at least as we'd normally think about such a person, chooses to perform actions that would cause sadness or anxiety, right, or even trauma. I know all sorts of people who are traumatized by the North Vietnamese, both Vietnamese and Americans, right? Very wicked people, the North Vietnamese, frankly, the communists. Horrible, wicked people. Worse than the Islamic terrorists. But does that mean that they lived a worse life because they didn't just go along with the North Vietnamese? You know? Or the good person commonly recognized as willing to die for the political community. Aristotle talks about that, right? Is that choosing psychological health, right? You're not just undergoing harm there, you're dying, right? You're gone, at least as far as we know in this life, right? And psychological health isn't something that we have to desire or have is the highest good, whatever psychological health means. So if that's what we mean by happiness, you might say, okay, well, some people want happiness, other people want to be useful, other people want excitement. You've got a lot of different things. It's up to you to choose. So when we think about happiness in the sense of ethics, it's just what's a worthwhile life, a life that makes sense. When people act, how do you explain the acts in terms of certain goods, right? I went to lunch at the cafe. Why? To eat. That's what made sense of my going to the cafe. Also to meet somebody. That's another benefit, right? And so we only make sense of actions in terms of the goals. And do those goals, in fact, make sense? Right? Do those goals make sense? Sense. And then the goals then that make sense or not are connected with what kinds of things that we are, right? I mean, we see this in this text 3 that I had, right? It seems like humans, when we talk about the human good, the function, goals that humans just have by nature, there ought to be some sort of human function because we can see what? We could see different parts of the human seem to have some sort of function that makes sense of them. I could say, there's something wrong with my eye. And you say, no, it's just mechanistic. There's no good or bad in eyes. Well, tell that to me when I can't read the small print in my handout, right? It's because there's something wrong with my eye, because I'm growing old, right? It's not like It's not value neutral. It's bad for my eye. Or if I talk, or we can talk about different roles that people have. We can talk about, well, you know, he's a good businessman. He's a good sculptor. He's a good builder, right? Well, all these things have points, but we can't talk about being a good human being. That's the point of being a good sculptor or businessman, right? So the difference between good and bad. So it's this human good, which involves goods of the body to some extent, goods of that we share with other animals, like reproduction. And you might say, I know people like that. Like there are fish that go, and the woman leaves the eggs, and the men come and fertilize it and take off. And then the fish grow up with no parents. So, you know, so I can see, I know people like that too. That's great how that, no, right? I mean, different animals have different things with children. Humans, it takes forever. That's why we have permanent marriages. Not just these kind of, you know, people leaving their sperm everywhere and kind of, well, I'm sorry to be offensive or gross, but I mean, this is how other animals behave, right? Like your dog might do this or something, you know. But human beings, if you're looking at the human good and reproduction, you aren't just kind of reproducing and just kind of producing things here and there. Okay. But then there's living in society, right? And this is a human inclination known to the ancients. Cicero talks about it in the De Officiis. Right? This is properly human. Families are part of the human society. So these relations we have with the older, with the younger, with raising, with education, the political community, our interactions with each other, achieving a common good. And so that's why anybody can recognize, or at least anybody at one point in a decently healthy society can recognize that murder, theft, and adultery and blasphemy are all wrong. Right? Aristotle mentions murder, adultery, and theft as the three acts that, you know, just, you know, it's not that you can do them in the right, you know, but just at the right time, in the right way, in the right place. No, they're always wrong. Murder, adultery, theft. Right? Destroys the community. You're killing other people in their life. You're violating their family. You're taking away their stuff. All these things are just obviously wrong to decent pagans or just decent people in general, not just to people who know the Ten Commandments. Although know the Ten Commandments and read Thomas's commentary on them like you will, but don't think that other people aren't bound to know and follow them as well, right? If people don't know them, it's their own fault. So that's what these commandments do. They kind of tell you what's good, what's bad, how to live a good life, right? They don't always tell you what to do, especially in the homily today. The priest was talking about, it may have been another day, but there was a priest talking about commandments and how a lot of them are negative. Yes, they just kind of, they tell you, you do this, you're not going to live a good life, right? Adultery, murder, theft. Your life's not going to be worthwhile. I mean, you might repent, might be worthwhile in some bigger sense, might be worthwhile in the sense that other people see you as a warning, don't be like that. But just from your own perspective and your own action, it's not going to make sense. Right. So the human good, then, is an operation according to virtue. Virtue is acting in accordance with reason. The human goods. That's what the natural law is for Thomas Aquinas mostly, this ability to recognize acts as some way part of the human good. Okay? So that's the second point. First point, the goodness is relative to kind of a species. Second point, the human good is acting in accordance with reason, what's good for human nature. There are these rules of reason we can describe as the natural law. And that's a kind of moral goodness. Why? Because the source is within ourselves, our own reasoning and decisions. Your dog sees a female dog in heat, goes there. Your boyfriend can think about it, right? Your dog sees a hamburger, and unless there's a reason, he's going to avoid it. But you see that hamburger, and you might think, well, I've already had three or four meals today. Do I need another, right? Okay, so then it might seem, and this is something that happens a lot in contemporary discussions of ethics, that this view leads to a kind of egoism, right? Because, well, if it's good for you, then you're not really desiring it in itself, and you're just seeing other people as instruments for your own good. But if you think about both Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, what's good for you is good for you insofar as you're part of something more important than yourself. Okay? Right. Aristotle doesn't have a clear notion of the love of God. In fact, Thomas Aquinas thinks we can't love God properly as we're required by the natural law without healing grace, because we're just born corrupt and sinful, right? But Aristotle does see that people are part of political communities where the good's greater than that of the individual. And he sees that the whole universe has a certain order and perfection and goodness to it, and that the prime mover, which is immaterial in thinking, is separate from the universe. And so when we're thinking about it in our own good, it's not like we're thinking about our own good as if it's in opposition to another good. And we're not thinking about these other goods as always part of our own good, right? No. Our own good is part of a greater good. Now, this text 7 is interesting from Thomas Aquinas. Thomas considers the family and the political community. He writes, "One who seeks the common good of the multitude also seeks his own good as a consequence, and this for two reasons. First, because his own good cannot exist without the common good either of the family or of the city or kingdom. This is why Valerius Maximus says of the ancient Romans, they preferred to be paupers in a rich empire than rich men in a poor empire. Second, because given that a man is a part of a household and of a city, he must think about what his own good is and the basis of his being prudent with respect to the good of the multitude. For the good disposition of the part has to do with its relation to the whole, since, as Augustine says in Confessions 3, any part that is not congruent with the whole is unseemly." Right? It's the whole picture of things that we're acting with. But, of course, from the perspective, we can only control our own actions. We can't control other people's actions. Notice here, he's just talking about how there isn't a conflict. He's not talking about the relative weight. And those are two separate issues, right? One issue being, can I will another's good for their own sake? Secondly, can I will some other good more than myself and my own good, right? Other individuals we can will for their own sake, Thomas Aquinas would think, we just can't will their good more than our own good, unless it's God, right? Political community is not another individual. We can will that good more than our own good. So what do we have then? Seeking the common good is also seeking one's own good. And often our good is part of the common good, right? Now, the problem is our community might be deformed. We might not recognize this as a part-whole relationship. A lot of times when people think about the U.S. government, they think of it as like a contract, like justice between individuals. I pay my taxes, they're supposed to fix the potholes and make sure the electrical company is running and doesn't rip me off. And oh, they also supply defense from crooks, right? So this is, it's like a deal, right? Yeah, something like that. But then they say you have to die for your country and honor your rulers. I'm not going to honor, a private utility company, the executives in it, or I'm not willing to suffer for my utility company, right? That would be irrational. So it's impossible to actually live that way, but we have a lot of that language in our culture where we don't think about a real community and a common good that's more important than our own. And so you realize that for Thomas Aquinas and Christians, there's bigger common good. There's a bigger common good involved. So you have the common good of the family. You have a more perfect common good of the political community. That's all that Aristotle knew about. Then you have the common good of the church, of Christians, which is God himself directly, not just as the source of natural goods, but as the source of grace, making us sons of God and somehow sharing in the spiritual good, which is greater than anything we could ever think about or know about. Now, if we sin, we're depriving ourselves of the greatest good that you can imagine through mortal sin. I mean, greater than you can imagine, right? It's unthinkable, literally unthinkable for us. Well, it's thinkable in a way, but it's not unimaginable, ungraspable. But that doesn't mean that it's just before us, right? That would be a little bit distorted if we willed this good, the good of the community of Christians, for our own sake, right? And for Thomas Aquinas, this kind of structure shouldn't be that surprising because it's supernatural, but in some way it maps on to the natural. Naturally, everything's directed to God. Naturally, we should love God more than ourselves, and we'd be able to if not for original sin, right? So when we think about what's good for us and whether it's good to be bad, we're making a mistake because we aren't thinking about what's really good for us, right? If we thought about what's good for us according to our nature, things that even conventionally are viewed as bad are going to be bad for us, even on a natural level. And Cicero talks about that. It's not the punishment of the law that matters. It's the fact that you are made a deficient human being, right? You're like the whale sunning itself on the beach. Now, before the 1800s, right, most Catholics thought that that's generally how people are, right? Most people are failures as human beings. Most angels didn't go with the devil. Most animals more or less manage to behave decently. But most humans don't, Thomas says. Part of it because of our nature, it's combined. Part of it is because of the higher end to which we're called, right? But humans seem to be a particular failure. Well, this is what I was thinking to try to make it relevant to the readings from the Mass today. It was the passage from St. Luke on the narrow gate, which is interesting. It talks about how hard it is to get to heaven. But the passage about the numbers of people who actually do it, that's in Matthew's gospel. And that just says there's very few people that do it, right? It's easy. It's very hard for humans to be good. But that doesn't mean that it's bad for us to be good, right? Just because it's hard. But it means we have to think about what it means to lead a worthwhile life. And if we understand correctly the importance of the political community, the importance of the church, the importance of God, we can see that we perfect ourselves through loving God more than ourselves, through loving the political community more than ourselves. And this also involves loving humans for their own sake. And that ultimately is an answer that we can find to some extent in ancient philosophy. You're looking at those passages from Plato. And Plato, in his at least in the Republic, he tries to connect justice with the immaterial forms, kind of metaphysical justification. He tries to show the superiority of the philosophical life that's not just concerned with bodily goods. It's a kind of insufficient and fragile attempt. But often it's a good example of what people were able to do without grace. But certainly Catholics, we can read Augustine, we can read Thomas Aquinas, and we can understand much better why It's never good for us to be vicious. Okay, thanks. Questions? Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.